On the record, in the case of Dwyer versus Secretary of HHS, Mr. Powers, you have the floor this morning.
Yes, good morning, Special Master. The petitioner at this point would like to call to the stand Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, M.D. And Special Master, being on the record, and as Dr. Mumper approaches the stand, it's perhaps a little bit more than a housekeeping matter, but I conferred with counsel for respondent, and understanding the time and the scheduling pressure that we are under today, the parties have agreed explicitly that from Dr. Mumper's testimony in the King and the Mead cases, there was approximately 50 to 55 minutes of testimony that was non-case-specific background testimony. I've identified the pages in the transcript that would capture that testimony. The agreement is, has been implied that the transcripts would be filed in the Dwyer case, but I wanted to designate those pages specifically so that we can cover some of that material in 5 minutes here rather than doing it again for 55 minutes.
Exactly, and since I was present during the that testimony in the Mead and King cases, I've heard it before. So
that's and if there is a beauty to doing the omnibus proceeding and having all three of you sit in each of the test cases, this is an example of how that should work. And so, just for the record, then, if I could, Special Master, the pages we would be looking at would be from day 4 of those proceedings, and day 5. Yeah, it would be day 4. Which was May 15th, and the transcript pages are 1,187 through 1,228. And so we would just again notify the court and the parties that will be designating those pages and filing them as an exhibit here and incorporate that testimony by reference in Dr. Mumper's comments today.
And it is possible that those page numbers themselves may change as you all go through the process of making corrections to those transcripts, but based on the transcripts that are currently filed, we'll use those page numbers.
Thank you, Special Master. Good morning, Dr. Mumper.
Good morning.
Dr. Mumper,
let's go ahead and swear her in this case, even though she was sworn in the omnibus proceeding. Dr. Mumper, would you, you've got your right hand up, do you swear or affirm the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Now I'll say good morning, Dr. Mumper.
Good morning.
And for the sake of the record and the court reporter, could you spell and say your full name for the record?
Elizabeth Mumper, ElizabethMumper.
Are you a doctor?
Yes, I'm a pediatrician.
How long have you been a pediatrician?
Since 1983.
Now, you heard the discussion just a moment ago about the testimony that you gave in the King and Mead matters. Do you recall that testimony in May of this year?
Yes.
Do you recall at the beginning of that testimony spending a fair amount of time talking about your background and skills and training?
Yes, I do.
Well, to summarize, I just wanted to have you describe in this case your professional experience and take us all the way from medical school to today, your professional experience.
Medical school at Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, internship at the University of Massachusetts, residency at the University of Virginia. I was asked to be chief resident, which involved an extra year in pediatrics. I spent 5 years in private practice, 11 years teaching in a residency program, and since 2000, I have had a private practice that is partially general pediatrics and partially dealing with children who have developmental and behavioral problems. I'm also the medical director of the Autism Research Institute and the clinician in charge of the physician's training, the clinician seminars for Defeat Autism Now.
What's the name of your private practice?
The Remlin Center.
So your three professional positions right now would be director of the Remlin Center, correct?
Yes.
And director of the Autism Research Institute?
Yes.
And then the third would be the medical director for Defeat Autism Now.
Right, and that very much goes with the Autism Research Institute responsibilities.
So the responsibilities in those two positions do overlap?
Yes, that's correct.
Did you prepare an expert report in this case, Colin Dwyer's case, that you're here to testify about?
Yes, I did.
When you prepared that expert report, what materials did you have available to you that you relied on to prepare that report?
At that time, I had a number of medical records, not the actual complete medical records. And at that time, I also had information from various labs and physicians. I had a rough draft of the mother's affidavit and other materials as forwarded by your law firm.
Did you also have available to you the materials that you relied on to prepare a report and offer testimony in the King and Me cases?
In that I had done them, I did not physically have them present with me at the time I prepared the report.
Would it be fair to say that you relied on those materials in preparing your report?
Yes.
Since preparing your report and appearing here today, is there any additional information that you have available that you used that you're going to rely on in your testimony?
Several things. One is that I received more medical records after the filing of my report. Specifically of interest were some even number pages from Dr. Bach that I did not have the first time due to a scanning error. I also had the opportunity last night to listen to the parents' testimony on audio and to meet Mrs. Dwyer.
When you say you listened to the parents' testimony on audio, you're speaking about Maria and Timothy Dwyer's testimony?
That's correct.
So you were not here in person to hear their testimony, but you heard the audio download?
That's correct.
Also, since you testified in May, are there any additions to your curriculum vitae that would be relevant to your skills and qualifications to testify?
Other than being invited to attend a autism think tank in mid-June and several lectures in Italy, no.
And when you say several, the lectures in Italy, are those lectures that you've already done?
Yes.
What was the subject of those lectures in Italy?
Essentially, I was talking about the use of assessment of medical problems in children with autism to guide therapeutic decision making.
Were you invited to give those to medical professionals?
Yes, I was invited by a medical professional. The audience was medical professionals and also parents.
Finally, then, since your testimony, you mentioned that your testimony in King and Mead, you mentioned that you were invited to a think tank. What think tank is that, and what's the subject matter that's going to be discussed at the think tank?
Well, actually, we already were at the think tank. They invited 30 leading clinicians in the autism field and researchers in autism from around the world to participate at a think tank at Ratna Ling in California. The subject of it was to get an update on the advances in the research and try to coordinate that with the clinicians' work in order to move the autism treatment and research agendas forward because we face such an overwhelming number of these children.
So from what you're describing and certainly what you testified to in the King and Mead cases, would it be fair to say that a significant portion of your practice is devoted specifically to neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism?
That's true.
Approximately how many children do you see in a given year in your pediatric practice, just approximately?
Oh, gosh. About 1,700.
And do you have a rough sense of what percentage of those children that you see in your practice are children with autism spectrum disorders?
The percentage in numbers is lower than the amount of time I spend with them because they're more time consuming. About half of my time is spent taking care of children with autism spectrum disorders.
So it would be fair to say that's a significant focus of your professional practice and your professional training and professional background.
That's true.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit and start speaking specifically about Colin Dwyer's case.
Okay.
You did mention that you saw his medical records in the course of preparing your report. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Could you describe, in general, the impression you had of Colin Dwyer's overall physical health from birth through the age of 1 year based on your review of his medical records?
It seemed that he was a healthy baby who was the product of an uncomplicated pregnancy. He did not have a difficult birth. He was healthy initially and had an uncomplicated newborn stay. From reviewing his well baby checkups, it seemed that he was actually quite healthy with only a few things that are typical in children that in the first year of life, like a little bit of a pink eye or eye infection, but nothing that would lead me to characterize him as a chronically ill child. And he seemed to be meeting his developmental milestones as recorded by his pediatricians on his well baby checkups.
And when you say recorded by his physicians on the well baby checkups, what specific developmental milestones do you recall seeing in the medical record that lead you to conclude that he was meeting his developmental milestones?
Well, at each of his well baby visits, the pediatricians ask questions about development in several domains, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, and language typically. And as we went through the first year of his life, the pediatrician documented that he was doing things such as rolling over, sitting up, crawling, cruising, and walking. And actually, in terms of gross motor development, he was actually a little bit precocious in that he was walking by 9 months and walking very well by a year. In terms of his language development, they talked about him initially smiling and being responsive and making eye contact as early as 7 weeks of age. They talked about him having babbling and then developing 3 to 5 words by his 1 year checkup. And 3 to 5 words is really very good for a child at 1 year. We typically expect them to have mama or dada, usually dada, plus one or two other words. And so that seemed to me to imply very normal language development at that time.
In fact, let's take a quick look at one of the medical records. This would be Exhibit 1, page 70.
I have it.
And we'll pause, Dr. Mumper, because we want to get it up on the screen here so that the special master and counsel can be able to see this too. So take a look at your monitor there, okay, Doctor, and let's make sure that the paper you have in front of you is the same thing you see on the screen. Is that the same thing?
Yes.
Do you recognize that document?
Yes, it appears to be the one-year checkup for Colin Dwyer.
There is a highlighted section about one-fourth of the way down on that page. Can you describe for the special master what that highlight is and why it's significant to you?
The highlight is looking at the classic developmental milestones. The first is language, and the pediatrician recorded that he was saying 3 to 5 words, which is normal for age. The second word, which is pincer, refers to pincer, being able to pick up objects or bring the thumb and index finger together. That's also a classic one-year-old milestone that you would like to see the child exhibit at that time. And then they wrote exploring, which means that this is a child who had gross motor skills enough that he was able to actually explore his environment.
So based on this chart note from his one-year well baby visit, do you see anything at all on that chart indicating that there were any delays or problems with his health or development?
No, I don't. And in fact, the pediatrician actually documented that he or she heard babbling and an occasional word. So this wasn't just based on the parents' history.
And speaking of the parents' history, you did hear, you mentioned earlier via the audio download, the testimony of Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer that was given yesterday, correct?
Yes, I did.
Did you hear anything in their testimony that was inconsistent with the description of Colin's health, well-being, and development up to the first year of life from the parents?
No, I did not.
Let's start moving into the second year of life, and we're going to put another exhibit up for you, Doctor. This would be Exhibit 1, page 67.
I have it.
And we'll get it up on the screen. And we will, I think we will quickly have a routine for handling the exhibits. I want you to take a look at your monitor and confirm that what you see there is the same thing on the paper. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you recognize that document?
The 15-month well baby checkup for Colin Dwyer.
What on that well baby checkup doctor's note do you feel is significant, if you could explain that to the special master?
The pediatrician documents developmental milestones, which includes the phrase talking some, running, climbing, problem sleeping like brother.
You mentioned talking some. Is that note significant to you as a pediatrician?
My interpretation is that the pediatrician was documenting that the child was talking and that implied that he was having normal talking at that time. I would expect if there were concerns that he or she would have said something like not talking enough or language delayed or words less than expected. So the fact that he was talking some, I view as a recording of a normal milestone.
Again, anything in this record that would indicate that Colin Dwyer was developmentally delayed?
No, I do not see evidence for that.
Also, again, referring to the parent's testimony, you recall there was testimony about his development up through 15 months. Is there anything in the parent's testimony that you listen to that's inconsistent with this history of meeting milestones and generally being in good health?
No, there was not.
In your review of the medical records and review of the other materials specific to Colin's case, did you see anything in those records before the age of 20 months indicating that he was failing to meet any developmental milestones?
No, I did not.
Did you hear anything in the parent's testimony that indicated to you as a medical doctor that Colin was missing developmental milestones before the age of 20 months?
No, I did not.
At some point, did you see anything in the record indicating that Colin might not be meeting a developmental milestone?
The well baby visit of 20 months on July 10th, the year 2000.
Let's go ahead and take a look at that. I assume there is a medical chart note on that, Doctor?
Yes.
That would be Exhibit 1, page 63.
That's correct.
And that's on the computer monitor there on the witness stand. Take a look at the monitor, and let's just make sure we're all looking at the same paper.
Yes.
Do you recognize the document that's on the screen?
Yes.
What is that document?
The 20-month well baby checkup for Colin Dwyer.
Now, you mentioned this was the first indication that you saw in the record of a possible developmental delay. Can you point that out in the note to the special master and explain the significance?
There are a couple of notations. One is about a fourth of the way down the page where the record denotes that he says a few words, and in parentheses it says 3 to 5. That would be the expected language for a child somewhere in the range of 1 year to 14 months of age. So the quantification of the words there suggests a delay. Then under the impression, there is a notation about the speech, and in the plan, they suggest a follow-up at 2 years, but make the notation to check the speech at 2 years.
What is the significance of those notes to you? What does that tell you as a medical doctor who treats children? What does that tell you about Colin's developmental course at the age of 20 months?
It suggests that the pediatrician is starting to be concerned about the child's language, but that they were not panicked at his lack of language such that they instituted any kinds of emergency evaluations.
Again, similar questions to what we covered before, but you did listen to the parents' testimony yesterday. Anything in their testimony that is inconsistent or at odds with the information you see in the exhibit that you just described?
No, there was not.
So in summary then, Doctor, from birth up to 20 months, do you have an opinion about Colin's developmental progress?
It seems that he was meeting developmental milestones, at least as documented by the 15-month checkup. At the 20-month checkup, even though gross motor skills and fine motor skills such as eating were normal, there was an initial concern about speech. So it is difficult for me to pinpoint the exact time that the speech may have become a problem, but by 20 months of age, it's raising a flag for the pediatrician.
And there's certainly nothing before 15 months. In fact, up through 15 months, it would be fair to say the record reflects more likely than not that he was meeting his language milestones.
That is correct.
I want to back up for just a moment, back up chronologically. You talked about Colin's birth.
Yes.
Did you also have a chance to review his birth records? If you recall, these were records that only became available fairly late in the proceeding and certainly after your report. Did you get a chance to look at the birth records in particular?
Yes, I did.
You touched on your review of his birth and delivery earlier. I want to go back to that topic. Did you see anything in his birth record indicating that he was unhealthy or in distress during labor, delivery, and birth?
No, I did not. But I did see one important finding when I got the birth records that I did not include in my report. It appears from the records that he actually received a hepatitis B vaccine at birth, which was not reflected on my initial report. And I would not have expected that because in the report that I had, there was documentation that he had gotten a hepatitis B vaccine at 13 days of age, and then another one at 7 weeks, and then another one at about 6.5 months. And the initial series for hepatitis B is typically 3 vaccines. And some hospitals give hepatitis B on day one. Our hospital many years ago decided not to do that, and so our local pediatricians typically give hepatitis B either at 1 or 2 months and start the 3-shot series then. The reason that I'm concerned about this is that it actually means that he got 3 injections of hepatitis B vaccine prior to 2 months of age, which is a time that I perceive as a special vulnerability, particularly with regards to handling potential toxic insults. And so the thimerosal that he received on day one of birth plus what he received at 13 days and 7 weeks makes me relatively more concerned than I initially reflected in my first report.
Okay. And in your report, do you have the report handy with you, Dr. Mumford?
Yes.
Because I just want to be as clear as we can in discussing the facts in your report. If you turn to page 3,
right,
you'll see that there is the shots that Colin received are listed, and the ethyl mercury content per shot is listed. Do you see that sort of in the middle of the page?
Yes.
So is what I want to make sure we capture what you're saying. You're saying that the hepatitis B in your report shows 3 different immunizations, and you're saying there would actually be 1 additional immunization that was given November 10th.
That's correct.
Okay. And that would then change the total mercury exposure from 237.5 micrograms to 250.
That's correct.
Okay. Did you see anything in the medical record indicating that Colin's mother, during the time that she was pregnant with Colin, was exposed to anything that might be associated with the appearance of autism in a child that a woman would be carrying to term?
No, I did not see it in the record, and I actually asked about that also last night and did not perceive any risk factors based on both the written record and her report.
What risk factors were you considering and looking at and then ruling out? Can you describe those for the special master?
We're concerned about potential illnesses of the mother during pregnancy, especially viral illnesses such as influenza or rubella. We're concerned about potential exposures through medications, specifically valproic acid, thalidomide, terbutaline. And in asking her about those medications last night and reviewing the records, there was no history that she received any of those. She also did not give a history of having an unhealthy pregnancy. In fact, her husband referred to her several times as a healthy girl during the pregnancy.
And from your review of the medical records, listening to the testimony, and speaking with Mrs. Dwyer in person, is there anything to indicate that she was smoking cigarettes during her pregnancy?
No, she specifically told me she did not.
That she was consuming alcohol during her pregnancy?
No.
Now we're going to go back up in time and catch up with where we were chronologically. We spoke about the chart notes at 20 months. I want to then start moving forward in time from that 20 months. What was the next thing that you saw in the medical record that you recall that indicated that Colin Dwyer may have developmental delays of some sort?
At a visit marked 3/22/01, it was marked as a two-year checkup. He was actually a little more than 2 years at that time. I initially thought this was just a routine checkup, but I realized last night that the parents actually had concerns at that time that they brought to the attention of the pediatrician.
Okay. Let's go ahead and get that medical record on the computer monitor, and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about that. This is going to be Exhibit 1, page 60.
I actually think it's page 61, maybe.
Let's try page 61. Apologies. Is that what you see on the monitor now? Is that what you have on paper in front of you that you were describing?
That's correct.
Okay. If you could explain for the special master what this document is and what you find significant.
This is the record of his two-year checkup. And in the record, it's reflected under neurologic exam, speech-language delay, and there appears to be an exclamation point after that. The pediatrician goes on to form an impression that the child had a speech-language delay, and under the plan said to EI, which is an abbreviation for early intervention, for speech, and they go on to say, I stress the importance of the evaluation, or I stress the importance, I'm adding, of the evaluation.
Okay. Now, you're describing that language specifically. I'm assuming it's a significant language to you as a professional pediatrician. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Why is that language significant, particularly compared to the note at 20 months?
To be stressing the importance of an early intervention evaluation and to put an exclamation point after the word speech and language delay imply to me that this person was very concerned about the lack of speech, and that I suspect that they looked back in the record and saw normal language at a year and then listen to the parents' history where the child was actually losing language milestones and losing words in addition to not continuing to progress. That to us is a very big red flag to look for problems.
Among the problems that one would look for when you see this kind of red flag, is regressive autism one of those problems?
Yes, it is.
In your review, and we can pull this down, unless, Doctor, is there anything else on that note that you wanted to describe for the
No.
court? In your review of the records and talking to Mrs. Dwyer, listening to the parents' testimony, do you have an opinion about whether Colin Dwyer regressed into autism at some point in his life?
I do believe that he regressed into autism.
Can you tell the court what that opinion is based on, just in general, now that we've gone through the chart details?
Finding numerous documentation, both in the medical record and by parent report, of normal developmental milestones, and then finding clear documentation in the medical record and parental concern about a loss specifically of language milestones, and also documentation of behavioral changes.
Do you recall what behavioral changes stuck out for you that were significant that inform your opinion that Colin regressed?
It was quite dramatic to listen to the parents describing this child who would go around the streets of New York in a stroller and be very interested in his environment and have play with his brother and appropriate social interactions, and then change into a child who did not want to sit in the stroller, who started having tantrums, who withdrew from social interactions that he had particularly enjoyed previously, who went from doing very creative play with blocks where he would enjoy building structures and then knocking them down, which is very age-appropriate behavior for a toddler, to very rigid play where he took the blocks and lined them up and became very upset if the organizational structure was disrupted. He went from a child who responded positively to seeing his mother come home from work and expressing distress when she would leave to someone who wanted to withdraw and sit in the corner. He went from a child who at his 13-month age at Christmas was interacting as you would expect a 13-month-old baby to do and expressing interest in his environment to a baby who the next Christmas was withdrawing from interaction and ended up being a spectator to Christmas, essentially. So that very vivid clinical description, as well articulated by both parents, in conjunction with a pediatric record that reflected normal development and then red flags, makes me very concerned about a regressive picture.
In this regressive picture that you described in Colin, is that something that you've seen before in your professional practice?
It is.
Is that pattern something that you term regressive autism?
It is.
Is that a pattern of progress and regression something that you see reflected in the medical literature as regressive autism?
Yes, there have been several documentations in the medical literature trying to determine what percentage of children have regressive autism, how to clearly document that, but it is documented to occur.
In reviewing Colin's medical history and listening to his parents' testimony and speaking with Mrs. Dwyer, did you notice anything in the record suggesting that he had behavioral problems that began at about 6 months of age?
I did not.
Do you also recall looking at his growth chart from birth up through the age of two?
Yes, I do.
Do you recall that at around 6 months, his weight was about the 25th percentile?
Actually, I have at about 6 months that, let me make sure I'm looking at the right one, that his weight was at the 50th percentile at six months.
And then as you move forward, does his weight percentile change from 50%, sort of the very middle of the bell curve?
Yes, it does. At both 12, 15, 20, and 29 months, it is around the 25th percentile, but clearly following that curve and not showing any further drop-off.
And at the 25th percentile, is that within one standard deviation of the 50% mean?
Yes, and it basically means that he weighs more than 25% of babies his age.
Would that be considered a normal weight for a child of his height and age?
Yes, it would be.
And it would be because it's within that first standard deviation of the mean, correct?
Right. And he does not show, when you look at where he initially started out on his growth chart, which was just a little bit above the 50th percentile, looking at the growth pattern overall, it is within what I would consider normal. Now, having said that, whenever we see a child starting to cross percentiles, we try to evaluate possible reasons for that. And things could include not eating enough or being chronically ill or having chronic diarrhea and malabsorbing. So one would consider the potential medical problems and be alert to the possibility of either gastrointestinal problems or central nervous system problems or a wide variety of metabolic problems.
But certainly nothing in the medical record indicating that during the period where he went from 50% to 25%, there's nothing indicating that he had behavioral problems in that period of time, is there?
No, I did not see that. Now, at 12 months, it was mentioned that he was having some sleeping problems, similar to that which his brother had. And sleeping problems are very common in all children, including children with autism. And so that itself I would not consider a behavioral problem, but that was noted in the record.
Is there anything from the testimony of the parents that you heard indicating that Colin Dwyer had behavioral problems beginning at about the age of 6 months?
No, I did not see any documentation of that.
So you've now described Colin up through the age of 2 years old.
That's correct.
Now, at some point, Colin did receive a medical diagnosis indicating that he might have an autistic spectrum disorder. Do you recall that?
That's correct.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and put Exhibit 1, page 55 to 56 on the computer screen there for you. And do you recognize that document on the screen?
Yes, that is a neurologic consultation by Dr. Irving Fish, who was a pediatric neurologist.
How old was Colin at the time that he was examined?
The record shows 2.5. He was born in November. So he was 2 years and 7 months.
So just over 2.5 years old. The record speaks for itself here, but what's the significance of this document as you would explain it to the special master?
The pediatric neurologist diagnosed him with a pervasive developmental disorder with significant autistic features.
Why is that significant to you?
Because someone who is trained with expertise in pediatric neurology diagnosed him with an autism spectrum disorder at this time.
Is that the first point in the medical record that you saw any indication that he had an autistic spectrum disorder as a diagnostic suggestion?
Yes, it is.
Okay, we can pull that document down and move forward a little bit in time. Now, do you recall in your review of the medical records and from the parents' testimony that Colin was ultimately taken to a Dr. Bach?
Yes, I do.
Are you familiar with Dr. Bach?
Yes, Dr. Bach is a integrative physician who practices in New York, and I have co-lectured with him on a number of occasions, been at think tanks with him, had the opportunity to have personal conversations with him about medical problems in children with autism.
Now, in preparing your expert report, there's a section that begins on page 4 of your report where you describe and ultimately rely on a series of laboratory tests and analyses, correct?
That's correct.
These laboratory tests that we're going to talk about here in some detail, these were all ordered and supervised by Dr. Bach, is that right?
I think they all were. It's possible that there are one or two labs that were ordered by Dr. Russell, but labs came from both of those sources.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and walk through some of these labs. And what I'm going to do, just so that you know, Doctor, is we will put specific pages up here that you referenced in your report, and I would like you to explain to the special master what those pages describe and why they're significant to you. That's going to be our general approach.
Okay.
And we'll try to move through these in a fairly brisk manner because they are captured in the report here. But let's start off with Petitioner's Exhibit Number 4, page 100.
I have it.
And on the computer screen, is that the document on the monitor that you have in front of you?
Yes, it is.
What is that document and why is it significant to you?
This is a laboratory evaluation that is based on a blood test that is looking for antibodies against neurofilament. The reason that this is significant to me is that Colin at this time showed an elevation in neurofilament antibodies. The other name for neurofilament antibodies has to do with glial fibrillary acidic protein. And with regard to our understanding of potential causation based on thimerosal toxicity, this lab result lends credence to our concern because it's demonstrating these glial fibrillary acidic protein antibodies. The GFAP is a way in which structure and integrity is provided to astrocytes. And with antibodies against those, I am concerned about loss of structural integrity of the astrocytes and ongoing neuroinflammatory processes. And the significance of the test is to make us consider in the differential diagnosis of his problems that there may have been a toxic insult that is affecting the glial fibrillary acidic protein that suggests neuroinflammation or reactive gliosis. That ties in to Dr. Kinsborn's testimony about the neuroinflammation in children with autism and the pathology in the astrocytes and problems with the glial cells, et cetera.
Now, the reference range on this is given as, I think it's 0 to 50, and the level that's recorded here is 53.
Right.
How, as somebody who looks at these results, how elevated is that in your opinion?
It's very mildly elevated because it's only 3 units above the upper limit of normal. I have seen children with this value as high as 63, I think. So I don't want to overstate that this is a huge elevation. I just want to use it as part of our composite picture that it is abnormal and that you would not expect a normal child without neuroinflammation to be showing these antibodies suggestive of neuroinflammation and reactive gliosis.
Let's go ahead then and move to page 102 of Petitioner's Exhibit 4.
I have it.
Can you describe for the special master what that is and, again, why it's significant to your opinion in this case?
This, again, is a blood test, and here the lab was looking for antibodies against myelin basic protein. This is significant to me because myelin is like an insulation in our nerve cells that's very important for speeding transmission of neurologic impulses. And to be making antibodies against that potentially would lead to degeneration of the myelin sheath. The most classic example of this is a disease called multiple sclerosis. And again, I would not expect a normal child without an autoimmune or neuroinflammatory process to be making antibodies to his myelin basic protein in the first few years of life.
Okay. Now, again, it's a level of 57, and the normal reference range, the upper limit of normal, would be 50. Can you describe, as somebody who's reviewed these types of lab reports before, how elevated that is?
This is more elevated than the other tests we just looked at. I do think this is a significant elevation. It's about 15% elevation, I believe, if I did my math right. So I would take that very seriously.
Okay. We're going to move ahead then and look at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 96. And do you see that on the monitor there?
Yes, I do.
Okay, again, can you describe what this is and what it tells you and why it's significant?
This is a blood test looking at oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is a big part of our theory of causation in that when children or adults are under oxidative stress, it impacts their ability to handle heavy metal toxicity. This is showing that his levels of reduced glutathione, which is the good form of glutathione that is expected to help a person with detoxification, immune function, mitochondrial function, acting as an intracellular antioxidant, and helping the gut epithelium, was low in the red zone, if this happened to be in color. The test also shows a quite elevated lipid peroxide measure. Lipid peroxides take it a step further and actually look at lipid damage by oxidants and excessive free radical activity. Free radicals are a cause of cellular damage, a cause of aging, and excess free radicals or loose electrons are a marked marker for oxidative stress. So not only do we have low levels of the glutathione that has all those important functions that I mentioned, but we also have high levels of the lipid peroxides showing this actual damage by oxidants.
And this is a lab result of July 16th, 2002. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We also have a lab result from December 17th of 2002, from later in that same year. This would be page 78. Of exhibit number 4.
That's correct. And this is essentially the same test with very similar results. So I don't think I need to explain it all again.
Right. We're now going to move into pages 96 and 97 of petitioner's exhibit 4. And we'll start with page 96. Is that what you have there? On paper and on the screen?
That's the one we... 96?
Yes, Special Master.
That's the one we started with on oxidative stress.
Oh, I'm...
Yeah, I think we've already done this one.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, and these were the so it would be page 97, the plasma cysteine panel. So I'm sorry, it would be page 97. Thank you, Special Master.
Okay.
Okay, and this is testing that, again, was done in July of 2002 at the same time that the testing you just described was done. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what does page 97 tell you, and why is it significant?
This is a blood test looking at cysteine. Cysteine is the amino acid that is the prerequisite for glutathione formation and has a crucial role in neuroprotection. And it is showing that it is outside the normal range in the low range. By inference, if you have a low cysteine, you would expect a low glutathione, as we documented. And so this is another confirming laboratory value to document abnormalities in this methylation pathway and therefore a reduced ability for the child to handle heavy metal toxicity.
Okay. And let's then go to page 80.
That is a blood test looking at plasma sulfate, and sulfate is part of the detoxification mechanisms by which we all are able to excrete toxins, and this is demonstrating that it is below the normal range. This is to be expected given what we know about the child's glutathione status and cysteine status, but is more specific documentation of that detoxification function of that whole metabolic pathway, showing that it would be functioning suboptimally.
Okay. We're going to move on then to petitioner's exhibit 4, page 93. And do you see that on the screen?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Could you describe for the special master what this document is, what it tells you, and why you believe it's significant?
This is a urine looking at toxic metals. It was obtained on September 20th, 2002. It is crucial to note that according to both the mother and the treating physician who I spoke to personally about this, this was not actually a post-provocative urine with DMSA. It was actually the baseline urine. A common practice is to initially do a urine for toxic metals in the natural resting state of the child and then to give a chelating agent to try to look at body burden of various toxic metals. And in this specimen, which is actually a baseline specimen, mercury is essentially non-detectable, where the reference range would be less than 3 micrograms per gram of creatinine. And that is significant, particularly once taken in context with the post-provocative specimen.
Okay, let's take a look at the post-provocative specimen, and this, I believe, would be page 90 of Exhibit 4.
That's correct.
Okay, so what you see on the monitor is that the post-provocative test?
Yes.
Okay, and again, if you could describe for the special master what you see on this test and why it's significant for you.
What I see here is that after receiving an agent called DMSA, which is a chelating agent that will potentially help the body get rid of lead and mercury, that the mercury rises to 17 micrograms per gram of creatinine, where normal would be less than 3. And the bar essentially goes off the chart into the very elevated range. This, to me, suggests that through the use of the DMSA, which acts by complexing in the metallothionine complex in displacing the heavy metals, this child excreted a dramatic amount of mercury. This implies that he had a significant body burden of mercury.
Now, you say it implies he had a significant body burden. Is it possible that it simply reflects ongoing exposure to sources of mercury?
One would not be able to answer that question purely on the basis of this lab test, but there are other tests in his record which lead me to believe that he did not have any ongoing sources of mercury exposure.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at some of those. We'll be looking at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 131.
This is a test on red blood cell elements.
And let me interrupt. So the tests we just looked at were urine tests.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and so this is a test that is based on drawing blood from colon.
That's correct.
Okay, please go ahead.
The red blood cell elements test is frequently used to make sure that children have adequate amounts of essential nutrients in their blood. So the first part of the test that's marked nutrient elements is giving an idea about the amounts of essential elements like calcium and zinc and magnesium and selenium in this child compared to a normal range. And it's given in the range of percentiles. So for example, this child who was on a gluten casein-free diet was having a calcium level that was around the 75th to 80th percentile. So that gives you evidence that his calcium was being adequately replenished by his supplements. We particularly want to look at nutrient elements in children where either chelation is anticipated or ongoing, because the biggest morbidities associated with chelation are when the chelating agent grabs an essential element instead of a toxic element. So Dr. Bach was being conscientious, I believe, trying to make sure that he had adequate zinc and adequate selenium and other essential nutrients. The bottom half of the test reflects potentially toxic elements. And the reason that this is very important to me is that the very first step when you're trying to deal with anyone who may have evidence of toxic exposures is to ensure that they're not having ongoing toxic exposures. Otherwise, you just end up chasing your tail as you try to get rid of something as they continue to be exposed. So in looking at this, we see that with regards to mercury, he did not have evidence of ongoing toxic exposures. I had the opportunity to ask the mother if they had moved to a different environment between the time he was a baby and the time this test was taken, such that perhaps there was an environmental component at the time of his infancy that might explain this big mercury burden, but she explained that no, they were in the same house, that there wasn't any change in industry in their neighborhood that would have been providing an environmental source of mercury. And so I thought this was very interesting in that it showed evidence against ongoing exposures that had happened within the previous 120 days.
And let me interrupt. Why is that 120 days significant?
Because your red blood cells turn over quickly, and on average, you've replaced them within 120 days. So if you're going to look for evidence of lead or mercury in the blood, you essentially are looking for acute exposures. And so by not having any mercury present here in the red blood cells, I do not see any evidence that he had ongoing exposures. And that, I believe, argues that we have to at least consider that his body burden could be coming from his inability to have handled the thimerosal in his vaccines.
And now, it's not that it's proof positive that that's the case, but it's would it be your testimony that it's consistent with that possibility?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's look at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 75. Do you see that?
Yes, that's another red blood cell element test that was done in December of 02. And two potential things of importance here to me. One is that once again, the mercury level in the red blood cells is not high, suggesting no ongoing exposures to mercury. The other thing that is important to me is that the selenium level is low. Selenium is one of the mechanisms that the body uses for glutathione function and to help get rid of mercury. And so it will be used up when the body is trying to do that process. We frequently supplement children with selenium. It may be in their multiple vitamin, or sometimes we give them extra selenium. It's one of the nutritional ways of helping the body itself to mobilize heavy metals the way that nature intended.
Now, I want to pause here for a moment on this idea of mercury exposures. Do you recall testimony from the Mead and the King cases that one source of mercury exposure in infants is through the mother's breast milk?
Yes, that's correct.
And that would be the methylmercury that would be passed, that the mom is exposed to in the breast milk and goes into the child. Do you recall that sort of testimony?
That's correct. Yes.
So it's true then that one potential source of mercury exposure for Colin Dwyer would have been breast milk, correct?
That's correct. But in this case, the mother explained to me that she did not breastfeed, that the baby was formula fed from the beginning.
Okay. So in terms of exposures to mercury, can you see anything in the family's testimony, conversations, medical record indicating any exposures to mercury other than the thimerosal-containing vaccines administered to Colin?
No, I did not detect evidence of other exposures.
I'm going to move ahead to Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 67. What is that document, and can you explain what you see there and why it's significant to the special master?
This is a urine test done at Metametrics Laboratories that is looking at a wide variety of markers in the urine that are essentially breakdown products of metabolism that are excreted in the urine. We use these tests in order to get biochemical footprints that might give us some insight into what is going on a cellular level with these children. The things that I found interesting and informative in this record included the lactate and then some of the citric acid cycle markers. The reason that the high lactate was significant to me, lactate is an anaerobic breakdown product of glucose, and it tends to be higher under anaerobic non-oxygen environments. And One of the things that can lead to an increase in lactic acid is lack of mitochondrial ATP, implying potential for mitochondrial function. Now, I need to be very clear for the special masters that there is a very long differential diagnosis of what can cause a lactic acidosis. It could be something like recent vigorous exercise or septic shock or significant vomiting and diarrhea that includes dehydration. So I am not in any way suggesting that a high urine lactate is the biomarker to prove mitochondrial dysfunction and abnormalities in anaerobic metabolism specifically. I'm saying that with that high marker, once again, it reflects the potential for an ongoing metabolic acidosis and is consistent with our concerns about the low glutathione in this child and therefore poor mitochondrial function and all the other things I elaborated. The other thing that is significant to me as a clinician is the citric acid cycle markers, many of which were elevated. A pattern that is seen in people who have heavy metal toxicity is that each of the heavy metals can have potential impacts on that citric acid or Krebs cycle. That cycle is how we produce cellular energy in the form of ATP. So when you have so many markers that are high, one of the things in your differential diagnosis is heavy metal toxicity. Specifically, an elevated succinate is one of the markers for an increased requirement of CoQ10, which is important in mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. Another important thing is that the fumarate and malate that are elevated can be markers of CoQ10 deficiency. And also the malate can be elevated with B12 deficiencies. So again, as a piece of evidence, even though these isolated markers cannot be overinterpreted, looking at the pattern, I see a pattern that suggests interference with the citric acid cycle, which is a very fundamental biochemical mechanism by which we produce cellular energy and therefore allow our cells to do their jobs.
Okay. Let's go ahead and look at pages 126, and we're going to quickly have page 81 after that, but we'll start with page 126 of Exhibit 4.
This is a lab test that is a pretty traditional lab test. It's basically a chemistry screen. And I mentioned in my report the fact that a number of Collins' CO2 measurements in his blood were minimally decreased. When I got extra records, I actually found that there were some that were decreased as low as 19. I need to be very clear to the special master that a low CO2 also has a huge differential diagnosis, and it can be low in acute illness and dehydration and any number of things that would cause metabolic acidosis. It also can be low if the child is screaming for a long time before the blood draw. And so I only offer this as consistent evidence that this child may have had a mild ongoing metabolic acidosis. In the records that I received after I wrote my report, I actually did see a normal value, which I had not seen at the time that I wrote the report. Okay. This I would characterize as a soft marker consistent with our concerns, but not diagnostic in any way.
And when you say this, you're referring to the entire sequence of results that would show reduced carbon dioxide levels in the blood.
Right. There are several. It just documents that this was present over time on a number of different occasions.
Okay. And then we're going to look at page 116 of Exhibit 4 also.
Okay.
And do you see that on the screen?
I do.
All right. What is that and why is it significant?
This test is a urine for amino acids, and this is one of the tests that we can use to assess the child's ability to build body tissue, since amino acids are the fundamental building blocks by which we build our bodies. There is a pattern here that he has extremely low levels of a number of different amino acids. The ones I was particularly struck by were initially ones that are in that methylation pathway, including methionine, which is the essential amino acid that's at the beginning of the methylation sequence. Taurine, which is an amino acid that's very important in the function of bile and also in detoxification, as well as some neuroprotection, and abnormalities in cystathionine and cystine. The taurine in particular, you'll notice, has a value of 14 where the reference range is 110 to 700. So this is an extraordinarily low amount of taurine, again telling me that he was at a relative disadvantage in terms of his methylation biochemistry and in terms of his detoxification biochemistry. Other things that are important to me is that his arginine, which is the first marker, was low. That's important for leukocytes and immune function. And in general, and glutamine was also low, and that's very important as a nourishing cell for the gut epithelium. The overall pattern of very low amino acids is concerning about his nutritional status and therefore his ability to do normal metabolic processes as I would like.
Now, we've covered in going through these exhibits the issues that you discuss in your report. You do describe getting some additional medical records between the time that you wrote and filed your report and your appearance here today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And among those were some additional records from basically from Exhibit 4, additional pages from Exhibit 4 that were the even-numbered pages that were not included in some of the scanning, correct?
That's correct.
Are there any pages within that set of documents that were of particular significance to you?
Yes, one that I found very interesting was the Metametrics Urine Organics Profile. I think it's Exhibit 4, page 68.
Page 68. Okay, let's go ahead and put that up. And again, this is not discussed in your report, but you have something to offer to the special master in describing this part of the evidence. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If you could go ahead and let the court know exactly what this document is, what it tells you, and why it's significant to your opinion.
The first thing that I looked at were the neurotransmitter metabolism markers. And analytes number 23 and 24 are oxidation products of epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And they, if they accumulate, they can actually act as cumulative neurotoxins if they're not appropriately removed. When these levels are high, the increased rate implies that there's either increased synthesis or increased synthesis and degradation of those products. These are products of catecholamine biochemistry. The catecholamines are those things that put us into fight or flight response. And so I view these as, again, contributing evidence that this is a child who may have been in ongoing sympathetic overdrive. The sympathetic nervous system keeps you agitated. The parasympathetic nervous system is the one that would keep you calm, relaxing, digesting your food, etc. It seems to me that these metabolites are consistent with the parent's story that Colin was severely hyperactive, referred to as having severe attention problems, hyperactivity, and climbing the walls was one of the phrases that was repeatedly used by the teachers. So again, in isolation, nothing that I would point to as a marker, but in concert with the rest of the evidence, supporting evidence for our concerns. He also had an elevation in analyte number 25. This reflects serotonin biochemistry. This marker can be elevated if a child is on SSRIs, or it can imply that there's an increased release of serotonin from either the central nervous system, the platelets, or the intestine. Again, in an isolation, not a big deal. In concert, more potentially supporting evidence. The thing I was most interested in was the markers number 26 and 27, kynurenate and quinolinate. And the reason that I found this particularly interesting is that when I was lecturing in Australia once, I had a long conversation with Dr. Richard Lord about quinolinate as a marker linking the immune system in the brain, and the fact that it interacts with NMDA receptors and glutaminergic neurons, which those are items of interest in this particular trial because of our theory of causation. And overstimulated neurons can degenerate, and this is called glutamate neurotoxicity. So one of the things that's been looked at is the ratio where a high quinolinate and a low kynurenate would lead you to suspect neurotoxicity. And it's a matter of some research interest because any agent that would change the balance of the synthesis of these two, of the substances of kynurenate and quinolinic acid away from this excited toxicity potential and toward the neuroprotective potential is of therapeutic interest. So you'll see that this is comparing the child on a percentile basis, and his quinolinate is above the 80th percentile, and his kynurenate, which is the neuroprotective factor, is low, below the 20th percentile. So that, I thought, was interesting in terms of the impact on neurotoxicity and the way that this ratio seemed to be saying that at least at this point in time, the child was tipped in the balance toward neurotoxicity and away from the balance of neuroprotective.
And when you say neurotoxicity, are you using that as a corollary to neuroinflammation?
Yes, neurotoxicity or neuroinflammation. And I need to be very clear that that marker does not in any way say what the neuroinflammation might be from.
Got it. And when you say the brain's immune system, are you talking about the brain's innate immune system?
You know, I don't know that I have enough biochemistry to answer that question with certainty, so I'd like to say that I don't know for sure.
Okay. But certainly with neuroinflammation.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the other two markers that I'd like to mention in passing is number 32, which is glucarate. That's a biomarker for a process called glucuronidation, and that's compatible with induction of enzymes to try to handle either toxic episodes or pesticide exposure or fungicides. It's actually not, to the best of my knowledge, what's used for mercury, but it is a marker that he may be also trying to detoxify other things by other measures. And then the pyroglutamate, number 33, is significant to me because that's a marker for either glycine deficiency or glutathione deficiency. And glycine is one of the components of glutathione. Glutathione, I think we've made clear our belief at how important that particular substance is. So what I'm trying to show here is a constellation of how we've shown glutathione is low directly. We've shown that cysteine, the precursor, is low. We've shown that another urinary marker also reflects the glutathione deficiency. So from multiple labs at multiple times, I believe it shows a consistent pattern.
Now, having described this last exhibit, this page 68, and described all of the lab results you talked about in your report, are there any other laboratory results that you feel are significant to draw the court's attention to, or does this exhaust the laboratory result portion of your opinion?
Well, I wouldn't say it exhausts it, but it was what I prepared as most illustrative for the special master.
Okay. Now, we're going to stop talking about the lab results, and as we come to a conclusion here, I want to talk a little bit specifically about Colin Dwyer's course of care and his overall health. Now, you've described how he developed normally. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And you described how he regressed, and you offered your opinion that it was regressive autism, correct?
That's correct.
Based on your review of the medical records and listening to the parents' testimony, what's your impression of Colin's course of care from the point, just generally, from the point of his diagnosis at 2.5 years of age moving forward?
First, it became very apparent that the parents moved heaven and earth to get all the help they could get for their child. They went into debt, they changed career paths, and they paid a huge amount in terms of time, travel, and money to try to get him the services that he needed. They sought out the best resources available to them geographically and the best schools, paying very high prices for good behavioral interventions for him. They traveled to meet a doctor that would try to address his medical needs. And I would say that looking at his pattern in general over time, he has clearly exhibited some periods where he seemed to be progressing well, some periods where he had challenges, some periods where he plateaued, and then other periods where he made progress again. So at this time, he is in a much better place than he was at the age of 2 when the father couldn't take him out in a stroller or they couldn't interrelate with him. Now he is able to do some things socially and be involved in some family outings, but I understood the father to say that they still couldn't take, you know, this child to a restaurant, which would be something that I feel bad about because he's old enough that they should have been able to do that for many years now. So I'm very impressed by their dedication, and I am very concerned that he is likely to have some residual problems in his future, as the father so well articulated yesterday.
Now, based on everything that you've reviewed in preparing for your testimony and preparing your report, ultimately, did you reach a medical opinion about what might have caused or contributed to Colin Dwyer's autism?
After looking at the records carefully, I came to the opinion that thimerosal-containing vaccines must be on the list of the differential diagnosis of what could have caused this problem, that I reasonably looked for and did not find other alternative sources of mercury, that I looked for and did not find other alternative diagnoses to for his pattern of regressive autism. And because his laboratory data and clinical course showed evidence of so many of the medical problems I would expect to be in a child with autism who had difficulty excreting toxins, it is my best professional judgment based on what I know as of this date that thimerosal-containing vaccines substantially contributed to his medical problems and his regressive autism.
Anywhere in the medical record did you see any evidence that Colin Dwyer is mentally retarded?
I did not.
Is there anything in your review of the parents' testimony, in conversations with treating doctors, in conversations with the parents, supporting the conclusion that Colin Dwyer is mentally retarded?
I did not see any evidence of that. And in talking with the mother, she shared a story that I believe was also in her testimony about very experienced clinicians, including a PhD psychologist at the McCartan Center, explicitly telling her that Colin was a good problem solver, that he had good cognitive abilities, and that he was progressing well intellectually.
And do you recall that his receptive language skills have improved over time while his expressive language has lagged behind?
That's true.
And the improvements in his receptive language, would that be consistent with the conclusion that he is not mentally retarded?
Yes, I do not find evidence that he's mentally retarded, although I have not personally examined the child.
Correct. There was also mention, in your differential diagnosis, would you look for potential genetic causes of autism? Are there identifiable genetic causes of autism in your experience?
There are definitely identifiable genetic causes of autism. There are several ways you can look for that. One of the most important things is to do a careful physical exam for what we would call dysmorphic features. These are things such as abnormalities of the spacing between the eyes, or abnormally low-set ears, or particularly shaped faces, or abnormalities in the hand lines, or the fingers, or the nails. And whereas I will say I did see several notations in the records that there was no dysmorphology. I did not see a very detailed genetic exam that specifically listed everything that they looked for. But on the basis of several experienced clinicians, a pediatric neurologist, and an excellent developmental pediatrician examining the child, they did not seem to find evidence of genetic abnormality. I did look carefully through the records to see if chromosomes had ever been done, and I did not find evidence of that. The mother told me last night that no one had actually recommended that to them. So I must assume that they thought that the yield on doing chromosome testing was very small in this child.
And when you say they had the opinion that it would be a low-yield series of tests to do, are you referring to the medical professionals that treated Colin?
Yes, I am sure that both Dr. Bach and I would assume Dr. Fish and from what I know of Cece McCartan, they would have all had that foremost in their mind to do if they felt it was indicated, I believe.
And the fact that they did not indicate it at all, does that tell you that there was not a genetic component that ought to be pursued?
It tells me that they did not suspect it. I can't say that we've ruled it out because we haven't done all the possible genetic tests that could be done in this child. There's ever-increasing amounts of microarrays that could be done to detect subtle abnormalities.
Okay. And finally, the medical opinion that you just expressed about the role of thimerosal-containing vaccines in Colin Dwyer's regressive autism, is that an opinion you hold to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
It is.
Thank you. I have no further questions right now, Special Master.
We have 5 minutes.
Why don't we take a little longer, take a mid-morning break, a restroom break before we begin. Let's reconvene at 25-2.
Mm-hmm.